Conor Lamb gets out the vote, Rex Tillerson is out at state, and Stormy Daniels wants out of her deal. But we're all in on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Conor Lamb appears to have eked out a victory in Pennsylvania's 18th district. Is it too soon to call Tuesday's special election a bellwether for the midterms?
What we're seeing are Republican women joining with Democratic women and independents and casting a vote, in this case, to send a message to Washington and to Donald Trump that they don't care for his policies.
Plus, Rex Tillerson is gone from the State Department. How did his brief tenure compare to past secretaries of state?
If there is a perception that the secretary does not speak for the United States government, well then, if you're a foreign leader, it could be a prime minister or foreign minister, then the question is, why should I be talking to this person?
And we recall the New Hampshire primary of 1968, when LBJ's re-election hopes were dashed by Senator Eugene McCarthy.
By any political measure, President Johnson has suffered a major psychological setback in New Hampshire.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, 'cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 220 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Chaos? There's no chaos in the White House. President Trump has been trying to make that case for a year now.
I turn on the TV, open the newspapers, and I see stories of chaos. Chaos. Yet it is the exact opposite. This administration is running like a fine-tuned machine.
But the headlines lately have all been about the White House staff. The departures, the firings, the disenchantment. A record number of staffers have left the administration. And none bigger than what happened on Tuesday morning. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson fired by a tweet. Later in the day, Trump expanded on his reasoning.
Rex and I have been talking about this for a long time. We got along actually quite well, but we disagreed on things. When you look at the Iran deal, I think it's terrible. I guess he thought it was okay. I wanted to either break it or do something, and he felt a little bit differently. So we were not really thinking the same. Really, it was a different mindset. It was a different thinking.
Having a Secretary of State with different views on key issues is never a good thing. In addition to the Iran nuclear deal, Tillerson talked about using diplomacy over force in North Korea, which is the opposite of what Trump had been urging, at least until recently. Leaders around the world knew that Tillerson and Trump were not on the same page, knew that he didn't speak for the president, and that diminished his influence. So maybe it was time for him to go. But in firing him, Trump is surrounding himself with a cabinet and advisors who are in complete sync with him. No contrary views, no dissent, just loyalty. Trump has apparently switched his views on diplomacy with North Korea now that a summit with Kim Jong-un is possible. He also switched his views on certain gun measures. Remember this train of thought from a few weeks ago about confiscating weapons before due process?
Take the firearms first and then go to court. I like taking the guns early, so you could do exactly what you're saying, but take the guns first, go through due process second.
That drove conservatives nuts. Here's Tucker Carlson of Fox News.
Imagine if Barack Obama had said that. Just ignore due process and start confiscating guns. Well, Obama would have been denounced as a dictator. We would have denounced him first, trust me. Congress would be talking impeachment right now. Someone would be muttering about secession.
And when pro-gun rights Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania said there was nothing in his bill about raising the age of prospective gun buyers from 18 to 21, the president said this.
It doesn't make sense that I have to wait till I'm 21 to get a handgun, but I can get this weapon at 18. I don't know. So I was just curious as to what you did in your bill.
We didn't address it, Mr. President. Look, I think
why? Because you're afraid of the NRA, right?
Trump said he, on the other hand, was not afraid of the NRA. This week, a different story from the president. He withdrew his backing for raising the age, saying there was no political support for it. Trump's heresies on guns? Forget about it. Tucker, you can relax. For now. The White House is hardly relaxed about what to do regarding Stormy Daniels. She's a so-called porn star who apparently signed an agreement with the president's attorney in 2016, shortly before the election, not to discuss an alleged sexual relationship she had with Trump in 2006 that lasted several months. The non-disclosure contract, in which she was to remain silent, was signed in exchange for $130,000. But now Daniels, real name Stephanie Clifford, wants out of the agreement and wants to talk. She taped an interview with CBS's 60 Minutes last week, with the network planning to air it this Sunday. The Trump legal team is promising an injunction to keep CBS from airing the interview. For his part, the president said an affair with Stormy Daniels never happened, but his attorneys are working overtime to suppress what she may have to say. And that somehow, some way, leads to this week's trivia question. We know that Stormy Daniels made a brief bid for the Senate from Louisiana a few years back, but who was the last adult film actress to make it to a primary? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage photo of... No, no. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. On paper, it was an election that should have been there for the taking by the Republicans. A district Donald Trump carried by 20 percentage points in 2016, 17 points by Mitt Romney 4 years earlier. The previous congressman, in office since 2003, had run without Democratic opposition the last two cycles. But elections are not won on paper. And while we don't have a final tally as of this show, it looks like voters in Pennsylvania's 18th congressional district have elected a Democrat, Connor Lamb, to the seat formerly held by Republican Tim Murphy. At the minimum, Lamb has run even in what is accurately called Trump country. It was enough for him to claim victory Tuesday night.
It took a little longer than we thought, but we did it.
For his part, Republican candidate Rick Saccone said it's far from over.
You know, we're still fighting the fight. It's not over yet. We're going to fight all the way to the end.
Democrats argued that Lamb's showing was the beginning of the end for President Trump, or at the minimum, the beginning of their quest to take back the House. Republicans say that Lamb was Republican light, having views on abortion and guns that are anathema to the Democratic National Party, and that his campaign is not likely to be replicated by other Democrats in other districts. John Delano is the political editor for KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh and a longtime analyst of Pennsylvania politics. And he's here, whether he knows it or not, to make sense of it all. John, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Hey, Ken, it's always good to be with you. I'm delighted.
Well, thank you so much. And I guess the big question, the obvious question, were you surprised what happened on Tuesday night?
I think we were surprised at how very close it was, because polls coming in to us, both internal polls from both campaigns, suggested that Connor Lamb was going to win this somewhere between 3 to 6 points. Instead, the results that we have at the moment show a Connor Lamb Democratic win of just 0.2%, 627 votes at the moment. That could give way either way by a few dozen. But the bottom line is the unofficial count shows Connor Lamb the winner out of some 228,000 votes cast. A very, very close election indeed.
But of course, if you go back a couple of months ago, the thought of Connor Lamb making it close, let alone winning, was probably ridiculous to consider.
Well, it certainly was, because again, this district has not really elected a Democrat in years. And certainly when you look at the statewide elections across this district, the Democrats have had a very hard time. They've just consistently been defeated. Even more conservative Democrats like Bob Casey lost in this district. So this has not been a very popular district for Democrats. And I think what made the difference, aside from the various things that Conor Lamb did, and we can talk about those, was the fact that this election was essentially a referendum on President Trump and his performance in office.
And yet, when you think of that district, a lot of people say this is Trump country and that the president remains popular there.
I think that's true, and I think he is still popular, but I don't know that all his voters came out to vote. He was here twice. Ivanka Trump was here. Donald Trump Jr. was here. Kellyanne Conway was here. Vice President Pence was here. I mean, they threw everything into this district to try to get their voters to the polls. And I think there's some evidence when you look at the voter turnout in these respective counties that were Trump counties, and I might add Saccone counties on Tuesday, their voter turnout was less than the voter turnout in Allegheny County, which, by the way, is Greater Pittsburgh and is the only county in western Pennsylvania to vote for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump.
You talked about what Trump and Pence and all the other Republicans threw at Lamb. Republicans threw everything at him in commercials as well.
His name is Conor Lamb, but in Washington, he'd be one of Nancy Pelosi's sheep. Lamb would join the liberal flock and follow Pelosi's lead, voting the straight liberal party line for Pelosi's extreme agenda.
And, you know, you mentioned that Trump came into the district the Saturday before the election on behalf of Rick Saccone, but I want to play a little bit of pieces of tape because you'd never know that this was about Rick Saccone when you listened to what the president was talking about.
That Washington, D.C., it got a lot of evil there, but we're getting it out step by step. A lot of evil. A lot of bad people. A lot of bad people. A lot of fake media. Look at them. A lot of fake media.
John, the obligatory shot at the press. I mean, we've heard that a lot from the president.
Well, I never take it personally. I'm figuring he's talking about you boys down there in Washington, D.C. You're right. I mean, his speech was basically all about Donald Trump and all about the things that he has used and bashed on the campaign trail.
And you mentioned that a lot of the president's speech on Saturday was really about Donald Trump. Here's the perfect example.
MSNBC, third rate. And NBC, which is horrible, their newscast, by the way, is not doing well on NBC Network. They're heading down the tubes. But listen to this. I did The Apprentice on NBC for 14 seasons. I made a lot of money for them. We had a big, successful show. Arnold Schwarzenegger failed when he did The Apprentice, and he's a movie star. Martha Stewart failed when she did The Apprentice, and I just kept chugging along. Every year it was a big hit. I mean, I did The Apprentice, made them a lot of money, gave them good ratings when they were absolutely dying, and they do nothing but kill me. NBC is perhaps worse than CNN, I have to tell you.
John, this was about Rick Saccone, wasn't it?
Well, you know, I have to tell you, most of the audience was probably not a resident of the 18th Congressional District. We saw license plates from Ohio and West Virginia, which are just a few miles from Pittsburgh, and I know that the Trump campaign sent out invitations to Eastern Ohio folks who supported the president. So, you know, this was a speech to a much more general audience than just the 18th Congressional District. And besides, these are his standard lines. You know, I've covered every Trump event in Western Pennsylvania and some in Eastern Ohio, and it's the same kind of speech everywhere. So, and his audience loves it. They eat it up, and they want to hear more and more and more. And he delivers. In fact, he delivered for an hour and 15 minutes that Saturday.
You mentioned, though, that it may have helped the Saccone campaign. Do you think it also helped the Lamb campaign?
Yes. It's interesting. In my reports on television that evening, I suggested that really the one factor that drew the turnout for Lamb over Saccone in communities in the South Hills of Pittsburgh in Allegheny County, was the anti-Trump sentiment. Even Republican suburbs voted for Conor Lamb over Rick Saccone. And what we're seeing, I think, frankly, are Republican women in particular across the board joining with Democratic women and independents, along with others who simply oppose the president, and casting a vote. In this case, it didn't really matter whether it was Conor Lamb or somebody else. They would have voted and come out to vote to send a message to Washington and to Donald Trump that they don't care for his policies.
And Lamb really didn't run against the president. Maybe he didn't have to.
Well, he did not have to. What he had to do was to try to find ways to keep the moderate Democrats, the moderate to conservative Democrats on board, or at least not energized to come out and vote against him. So by running an ad where he shoots an AR-15, and says he likes guns, and then during his debate on my television station, and I was one of the panelists, he simply made it quite clear that he would not take away anyone's guns, that he was not in favor of banning the semi-automatics. He didn't want to raise the age. He didn't want to do anything that most liberal Democrats and certainly the Democratic Party in Washington wants to do. That was not Conor Lamb. He was stating and making a statement to the Democrats of southwestern Pennsylvania, many of whom are lifelong hunters and NRA members, that he was not going to mess with that issue. He did the same thing by saying he would never vote for Nancy Pelosi to lead the Democratic Party. She's old and tired, and let's get rid of her.
My opponent wants you to believe the biggest issue in this campaign is Nancy Pelosi. It's all a big lie. I've already said on the front page of the newspaper that I don't support Nancy Pelosi. The real issues are the ones that affect your lives. I'll protect Medicare and Social Security. My opponent will cut them. I'll protect healthcare and education. My opponent won't.
You know, the one thing I'm thinking of, though, is that not every Democrat can. I don't know how much of an issue Nancy Pelosi will be around the country. I know she's very unpopular in many districts. But two, I don't know many Democrats who are going to run far away from Nancy Pelosi the way Conor Lamb did.
Well, he clearly made the right decision with respect to his district. And what Democrats tell me, and you're closer to the Washington Democrats than I am, is that the leader Pelosi understands that if you need to run against her in order to win, she doesn't care. But once you get elected and once you're down there in Washington, I think it's a different matter.
Well, you know, one thing we forget, or many people forget, is that this district, after all the millions of dollars that were spent in trying to win it, is no longer going to exist after this year. So win or lose, Conor Lamb is going to run in a different district this year, and I assume Rick Saccone will do the same.
Yes, the irony here is that by 2019, it is quite likely that we will have both a Congressman Lamb and a Congressman Saccone. And here's how that's going to happen. Rick Saccone is going to run in a new district that looks a lot like the current 18th district that Conor Lamb just won, except it won't have Allegheny County in it. So they're taking out the most Democratic areas that voted for Lamb. That part of Allegheny County will be merged into the 17th congressional district, now represented by Congressman Keith Rothfuss, a very conservative Republican. So that'll set up a battle between Congressman Lamb and Congressman Rothfuss, that is in a district that is even Steven. Either one of them could win. For Saccone, he's already said he's running for Congress in the new 14th district that is basically the old or the current 18th district, and he's the odds-on favorite to win there. So, I mean, it's all very crazy. And as I say, in the end, we could end up with both a Congressman Lamb in 2019 and a Congressman Saccone in 2019. And people will wonder, what was this battle all about?
I know. I'm just saying the same thing as you're saying. All the millions of dollars that were spent in this, all the airtime and the newspaper space and everything, and suddenly we're going to wind up with both of them in Congress, which is possible, not guaranteed. But I guess, you know, one thing at a time, right?
Right, exactly. And so I do think, of course, we don't want to prejudge this. The Republicans are contesting this election. On Wednesday, they made it clear that they were going to challenge these results. They've asked all four county election officials to impound the voting machines, to maintain the absentee ballots. They believe that, quote, irregularities occurred. They're putting together their allegations. We expect at some point they may file a lawsuit. It's a little premature because we don't have the final vote count. It hasn't been certified. It may not be certified for another week or so. Allegheny County is not expected to certify their vote until sometime next week, as I recall. And so this is a process. Once the vote is finally certified and Conor Lamb is declared the winner, then you can challenge the result in court. And so far, the Republicans are giving in every indication they're going to do just that.
You know, I'm sure you remember a special election in Western Pennsylvania in 1974 during the height of President Nixon's unpopularity. Democrat John Murtha won a seat previously held by a Republican. And many people said that it was a bellwether for what was about to happen around the country in November. Now, they were right, of course. It was a disastrous year for the Republicans in 1974. Do you see Pennsylvania 18 on the same scale?
Well, John Murtha, Jack Murtha, he was a wonderful guy, a good friend of mine. I knew him for many, many years. Jack Murtha was a Vietnam War vet. In fact, he was the first Vietnam War vet elected to the Congress. He was young. He was good looking. He had a good presence. There's a lot of similarities to 33-year-old Connor Lamb, a Marine. But I don't know how far to take it. I think that the anti, you know, again, 1974 was a very different year after the resignation of Richard Nixon, his near impeachment, the whole Watergate thing. I'm not sure that we have quite that level of scandal, although some might argue in the Trump White House these days. But I think that in terms of messaging, this special election in the 18th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, I don't think there's any way, particularly with so many Trumps coming to this district, I just don't see how you can argue that it wasn't a referendum on the president. He made it a referendum on himself, even as Saccone did by saying he was Trump before Trump.
John Delano is the political editor for KDKA-TV in Pittsburgh and a longtime analyst of Pennsylvania politics. John, it was great having you on The Political Junkie.
Hey, Ken, anytime. All the best.
The firing of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson this week was long in the making. We first heard inklings of it last summer when he allegedly called the president a, quote, effing moron. Of course, that was hardly the first time a Secretary of State had issues with the president who appointed him. Last October, I spoke with Ed Mahokanen, a political science professor at Texas State University and the author of American Statesmen, Secretaries of State from John Jay to Colin Powell. I'm replaying much of that interview this week. Well, you know, there's always tension, as you know, there's always tension between a president and his Secretary of State. But how would you assess the relationship between Trump and Tillerson?
Well, obviously it is strained at the moment, not only because of the alleged moron comment, but because President Trump appears to want to be his own Secretary of State, not only his own Secretary of State, but his own Secretary of the Treasury and all through the cabinet. So that makes any Secretary of State in his administration having to have a difficult position.
The fact that Tillerson held a press conference to deny he was quitting, I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
Yes, I don't remember a time earlier in history when that has so explicitly happened. There have been times when a Secretary of State like James F. Burns, who was President Truman's Secretary of State, his second Secretary of State, lost a lot of influence. And so there were rumors over the course of 1946 that Burns would be leaving. But yes, I don't think there's ever been a case where a secretary's actually had a press conference to say he was not resigning.
And we remember, I mean, I remember certainly, most people probably remember when Cyrus Vance resigned as Jimmy Carter's Secretary of State in the wake of that failed hostage rescue attempt in 1980. I mean, you obviously, the news is when you're leaving, but it's rare that somebody's making news by saying they're staying.
Well, the news reports I have read, and I've tried to read a range of them, suggest that President Trump, to put it mildly, is less than happy with that report about Secretary Tillerson's alleged comment about him. As you well know, Ken, President Trump, as a business person in his personal life, demands a high amount of loyalty from people who he views as working for him. And he carries that business model in with him to the presidency. So from his mind, he's the boss. And it doesn't matter if you're Secretary of State or you're the janitor who is vacuuming the carpet, you all work for him. And to have the Secretary of State, of all people, to have alleged to have insulted President Trump would be something that would be very difficult for President Trump to forgive.
But here's the thing, though. By making it clear that he doesn't agree with Tillerson's attempt at diplomacy regarding North Korea, Trump has sent a signal that he doesn't think much of Tillerson's views, and so, therefore, has that made him ineffective, and do world leaders think that he has any credibility?
That's an excellent question. From what I've been reading, foreign leaders have decided that the current Secretary of State does not speak for the United States government on important foreign policy issues. And that's just devastating. I mean, if there is the perception that the Secretary does not speak for the United States government, well then, if you're a foreign leader, it could be a prime minister or a foreign minister, then the question is, why should I be talking to this person? I've got other things that I need to do, which also means that there's recalibrations, especially in Europe, but also in China, over how do we achieve our foreign policy goals in the absence of someone who we can actually negotiate with who represents the United States.
Tillerson came to the job with no foreign policy experience. He was not a diplomat. He was the CEO of ExxonMobil. And while that may not be entirely unheard of, you also have a president who has had no political experience at all. So one would think, of course, this is a question in retrospect, but one would think that maybe choosing a more seasoned foreign policy hand might have made more sense?
Well, in fairness to President Trump, I mean, we have had some excellent secretaries of state who have really no prior diplomatic experience. I mean, I can think of William Seward, who was Secretary of State to both Abraham Lincoln and Andrew Johnson, who had extensive political experience. He had been governor and U.S. Senator from New York. But most diplomatic historians will consider Seward to be the second greatest Secretary of State in U.S. history. And Seward had a very good sense of transatlantic diplomacy, of the absolute essential goal of the non-recognition of the Confederacy by Britain and France, for example. And Abraham Lincoln, I mean, he served one term in the U.S. House of Representatives. I mean, that was his full experience at the federal government level before his presidency. So it really boils down to the abilities of the people who are given their respective jobs. And when I say abilities, I mean across the board. It's not just their political sense, but also their ability to work with other people, their ability to absorb new information, and to recognize that maybe the information they've just received is counter to their expectations. All that goes into being effective at the federal government level.
Well, you mentioned that Seward is the second greatest Secretary of State in history, and obviously that leads to the obvious question.
Well, most diplomatic historians will give the nod to first place to John Quincy Adams, who had extensive diplomatic experience for the United States, and he was tapped by President James Monroe to be the Secretary of State. And to my knowledge, I don't know if they ever had even met before that happened, but they had one of the most fruitful partnerships with the purchase of the Floridas from Spain, the establishment of the border between the United States and Spain and North America from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean, which dramatically increased the legitimacy of the claim of the United States to a Pacific coast. And then along with the stabilization of the northern border with British North America and the Monroe Doctrine. So, yeah, J.Q. Adams is at the top.
And he followed Monroe as president, correct?
Yes, he did. What's interesting is both Monroe and John Quincy Adams were Secretary of State and then president. And that was actually considered the normal succession, Secretary of State, then president. And then Martin Van Buren, who was Andrew Jackson, President Jackson's first Secretary of State, was very careful to accept the job, but to say, I don't expect to be president because of this appointment, because of what had happened under, you know, Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe.
So back then, back in the early 19th century, you had a succession of secretaries of state who ultimately moved up to the presidency. That hasn't happened in the modern times, has it?
I am trying to remember, now that you asked that, when was the last time that a Secretary of State became president? And I want to say it was James Buchanan, who was our last president before the Civil War, and he was Secretary of State for Polk. We have had very important political leaders who tried for the presidency, say like James G. Blaine, who was Secretary of State for President Garfield and President Benjamin Harrison, James F. Burns, who was a congressman and senator from South Carolina, and then the head of war mobilization was Truman, President Truman's second Secretary of State. Edmund Muskie was President Carter's last Secretary of State. But there's been a major decline.
I was going to say Muskie ran for president before he was Secretary of State. There was this woman, I can't remember her name, but last year she ran for president and she was Secretary of State, although she ran for president before and after her bid as Secretary of State, John Kerry as well.
Yes, Hillary Clinton is actually a throwback to that earlier period of U.S. history where presidents would pick party leaders for important cabinet positions.
In the more modern era, who would you rate as among the superior secretaries of state with the most influence? A lot of people talk about Dean Acheson under President Truman.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point, Ken. I would rank Dean Acheson very highly. He was a very astute reader of the distribution of power in the international system. But George C. Marshall, his immediate predecessor, with the Marshall Plan and with forging the Rio Pact, which was the first peacetime defensive alliance that the United States ever entered into. And I would name one other post-War II Secretary of State, and that would be James Baker III. He did a very good job during the coup, the attempted coup against Gorbachev of the old Soviet Union, and was very careful to be very stable and non-threatening during that time of upheaval. And also he was dead center involved in the coalition against Iraq during the first President Bush's presidency.
He also had the advantage of being personally very close to George H.W. Bush.
Yes, they had been friends for decades, and Secretary Baker had actually headed George Bush's Senate campaign of 1970 and also his presidential campaign in 1980 and then 88.
Now, I mean, I'm just thinking of people like Henry Kissinger also. I don't know how close he was to Nixon personally, but he certainly wielded a tremendous amount of differences regarding the opening to China and things like that.
Oh, sure. That's a very good point. It was difficult for anybody to get close to Richard Nixon. He's one of the more interesting presidents we have in that regard. But what's interesting is when you really think of a lot of Kissinger's innovations and successes, some of them, as you mentioned, the China actually occurred when he was National Security Advisor. But I would say, you know, finally ending the Vietnam War, which was at the very beginning of his secretaryship, and then obviously the treaty, or at least the armistice between Israel and Egypt, with, you know, ending the Yom Kippur War, was a very successful initiative of Secretary Kissinger.
Who would you rate as among the least effective secretaries of state?
Oh, gosh. I would say, unfortunately, Colin Powell. He was a brilliant man, had a lot of natural leadership abilities and charisma. But it appears that Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and the Vice President, Richard Cheney, were frankly afraid of Powell's rapport with the public and the press and did everything they could to undermine him. Cordell Hull was Franklin Roosevelt's first Secretary of State, and he served the longest of anybody from 1933 to 1944. And President Roosevelt loved to marginalize him. Pretty much Hull had no say on diplomacy with Europe and was relegated to Latin America and the what then would have been called the Far East, what we would call East Asia.
And we also, we can't forget Alexander Haig.
No. Alexander Haig, to borrow a term that Winston Churchill used to describe John Foster Dulles, Alexander Haig was a bull who carried around his own china shop. And, he was his own worst enemy. And President Reagan really did not like arguments. He did not like hallway gossip. He did not want people undercutting each other. And Haig had a sense of himself that just did not comport to President Reagan's sense of how the White House and the cabinet should be functioning.
Let me ask you a final question. It's something you alluded to earlier in the conversation. Can anyone be Secretary of State or an effective Secretary of State for a president who often runs his own foreign policy via Twitter or via impulse?
I would say the quick answer is no. And to be more direct, I really think it would be very difficult for anybody to be an effective Secretary of State for President Trump.
Ed Mahokanen is a political science professor at Texas State University, and he's the author of American Statesmen, Secretaries of State from John Jay to Colin Powell. Ed, it was great having you on the program.
Thank you very much, Ken. I enjoyed it greatly. Hope to talk to you again.
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you. Lay your body down.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last Democratic member of the House to win a Senate race in Texas? The answer, Lyndon Johnson. LBJ was a congressman from Texas's 10th District around Austin in 1948 when he won a controversial Democratic primary for the Senate, which was tantamount to election. He served in the Senate until 1960 when he was elected vice president on the ticket led by John F. Kennedy. And the winner is David Dennis of Washington, Missouri. David wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a Scuttle Button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest led off with a Don't Let This Happen to You, Vote for Ike button with a picture of a hole in a shoe. That was in reference to a famous photo of Adlai Stevenson sitting with his legs crossed and showing a huge hole in his shoe. The next button was for the late Wisconsin Congressman Les Aspin. There was a Joe McCarthy for President button, and finally one that read Run, Jesse, Run, with a photo of Jesse Jackson. So when you combine Shoe and Les and Joe and Jackson, you kind of get Shoeless Joe Jackson, the star outfielder in the early 1900s for the Chicago White Sox, who was later banned from baseball for life for his alleged role in the so-called Black Sox scandal, when he and others were accused of throwing the 1919 World Series. And the winner is Joan Steinberg of Scarborough, Maine. Yes, the same Joan Steinberg who won a Scuttle Button puzzle back in September of 2012. We'll have a new Scuttle Button puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Who came along in a puff of smoke?
Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe.
Strong as the heart of the mighty Oak.
Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe.
Lucky we to be having him. Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe. Just when the future was looking grim. Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe.
Came a long, long way to be with us today.
With arms of steel like Hercules. Feet as fleet as Mercury. He'll fight for us, do right for us.
He'll be a beacon light for us.
He's Shoeless Joe from Hannibal Moe. Go, 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 go.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It was seen as a slam dunk. Lyndon B. Johnson, the President of the United States, presumably seeking re-election, was a clear favorite in the 1968 New Hampshire Democratic primary. There was also a primary on the Republican side, but with George Romney having dropped out of the race and Nelson Rockefeller still insisting he wouldn't be a candidate, the GOP primary was hardly a contest. Richard Nixon won in a landslide. But back to President Johnson. His name was not on the New Hampshire primary ballot, but that was part of the strategy. Not having declared for a second term, he would be above politics. But that was hardly the case. Democratic leaders in New Hampshire were all the way with LBJ. They sent out cards to every registered Democrat in the state with the goal of having them pledge to write in Johnson's name in the March 12th primary. It's the closest thing to denying people the right to a secret ballot, fumed Johnson's opponent, Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy. McCarthy was challenging Johnson over his conduct of the war in Vietnam, which McCarthy opposed.
As I see the campaign in 68, the issue of Vietnam itself is a vital one, of course, and you could pass a harsh judgment on that war if it were isolated altogether from any domestic consequences or any other international consequences. But underneath all of this, I think, is a fundamental judgment that we're called upon to make as to what the real role of America is, to what direction do we want to give to America, and what influence do we want it to have on the rest of the world. And I see this is the fundamental test that we have to face up to in the electoral process of the year 1968.
The pledge cards were hardly McCarthy's only problem. New Hampshire Democratic leaders, such as Senator Tom McIntyre and Governor John King, implied that a vote for McCarthy would hurt America and help the Viet Cong. So, if you're a patriotic American and a Democrat, the choice was simple.
Be sure that you write in the name of President Johnson.
A massive Johnson write-in would be seen as a sign from the public that they wanted the president to run again. Certainly McCarthy, with little organization or money, wasn't going to represent a threat. But they failed to see what was happening on the ground. Young people were streaming into New Hampshire, boys and men shaving their facial hair. Clean for Gene, went the slogan, not to alienate the sensibilities of those in the Granite State. One of those young men was John Tague. A student at Amherst, he was one of McCarthy's top volunteers in New Hampshire. And he joins us now, 50 years later, to talk about that campaign. John, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Oh, thank you.
Well, how much of those sounds that I just played bring you back to 1968?
The modulated tone of Eugene McCarthy is unique. And it takes me right back to hear him speak. That's the way he spoke all the time. Very considered and thoughtful and intelligent, but not what you'd call a firebrand.
No, but there were people who, given their views on the Vietnam War and what the war was doing to this country, there was intense emotions going on there. Is that what got you into the McCarthy campaign?
Well, it got me thinking about it because I thought that the demonstrations up to that point in the student anti-war movement weren't accomplishing much of anything except to alienate the rest of the country. So I did look for some way to politically express an anti-war sentiment and then work on it. And that's why I looked for a candidate to take on LBJ. And as Herculean as that task did seem, even back then.
Was McCarthy your ideal candidate, or was he the best you, as an opponent of the Vietnam War, had?
I think it's probably a combination. I didn't really know him, and so when I met him and talked to him about running, I was very impressed. He had that manner of a person who you could trust and was obviously intelligent and had thought about this great deal.
What was your particular role in the campaign?
I was born and raised in New Hampshire, and my father's a Republican politician who had run for Congress, and so I was pretty familiar with the political scene, and I figured I could be of some help in the New Hampshire primary coming up. So I volunteered to work on the student part of it, and from Amherst, we would come up most weekends throughout January and February of 1968 and work in the through the headquarters in Concord, which was on Pleasant Street Extension and is now a cigar lounge and tobacco shop.
And so you were there just in the nicotine.
Yeah, you could say that. And you get away with it, too. Yeah, it was a very low level operation. And I can remember the first time I walked into this headquarters, statewide headquarters, consisted of one old pine desk and one staff person sitting behind it. And that was it. There wasn't anybody else around in January. So it seemed like this was just a hopeless thing.
But when we talk about, when we think about, you know, what went on in New Hampshire back in January and February and, of course, March of 68, we always think of, like, the knocking on doors and trying to convince voters. Did you do that? And what kind of reception were you getting?
I did, and I helped organize when we started getting appreciable numbers of volunteers from different colleges around. We had to send them out, and that was a big organizational issue, but I did go on my own share And I'm just thinking, I just thought of this morning, as a matter of fact, was one couple, I knocked on their door, and they grabbed me and brought me in and sat me down in their living room. And I knew this was going to be an intense conversation. Their son was in Vietnam and in combat, and they grilled me for half an hour about why I was not in favor of this. They obviously were bothered, and it was one of the heavy-duty conversation I think I've ever had.
Well, New Hampshire was a pretty conservative state back then, right?
That's right. A very Republican, even despite our Democratic office holders. It was still a very conservative, nationalist sort of state back then, and very much in support of the war, and that included my father. So we had a divided living room.
But your dad was a Republican. I mean, many Democrats supported the war as well, as like Senator McIntyre and Governor King.
That's right. And later I got to know Senator McIntyre very well and watched his conversion, which happened quite a bit later than this, to be opposing the war. But back then he was very much a Johnson Democrat and supporting it.
And it wasn't just young people coming to New Hampshire as well. It was celebrities too, right?
That's right. The most notorious case was Paul Newman, who came. And one of my friends who was coming up from Amherst drove him around. And at one point, one of the women who had shown up for the meeting at a supermarket went through the plate glass window trying to get to Paul Newman.
Let me play a little bit of Paul Newman from that campaign.
When you have areas where you feel your own rumblings and your own dissension and your own questioning, then I think it's necessary to get behind the senator now, early in the game, and not sit around and wait till you feel that you're ready to make a political commitment that's convenient to you.
You remember that too, those days, right?
Oh, yes. A lot of criticism, thinly veiled criticism of Robert Kennedy.
Well, the people who just sat and waited behind, right?
Yeah, that was a great expression. I can't quite think of it, but sitting on the mountaintop, howling at the moon, something like this, waiting. And yes, there was a lot of anger about that, and feeling that look, McCarthy is committed, he's going, and we ought to get behind him and not have half-heartedly waiting on Bobby Kennedy to announce.
Well, plus the fact that when McCarthy got in the race to begin with, he actually pleaded with Kennedy. Look, he said, I'll back you if you challenge Johnson. And when he refused, McCarthy himself decided to get in, right?
Right, right. And that led to a real split between the two men. But it happened, and the rest is history. But at the time of March 1968, it was just McCarthy. And it was only after that Bobby Kennedy decided to go ahead.
Well, but well, still staying before the primary results, was there ever a time you thought you were making headway or that you were making a difference?
Well, what happened was the phenomenon of the students really started to get a lot of attention. We had busloads by the end of it, towards the beginning of March. We had busloads and busloads from all over the East Coast, really, coming to New Hampshire, and it was startling and worrisome because we didn't know what my fellow New Hampshireites were thinking at the time of all of this. But clearly, it was a phenomenon, and it showed a tremendous amount of stored up energy on this issue. And we didn't know if that was going to directly translate into votes, but we certainly felt we were part of a historic movement of some kind, and that it hopefully would have a constructive outcome.
Well, then came primary night, which was March 12th, and it was an incredible result. Johnson got 49% of the vote. McCarthy got 42%. Not the victory McCarthy supporters dreamed about, but a stunner nonetheless.
By any political measure, President Johnson has suffered a major psychological setback in New Hampshire.
Do you agree? I mean, a lot of it is perception, and of course, McCarthy didn't get the win he wanted, but that was a stunner.
Yes. Yes, it was the clearest example of winning by losing. Winning and losing, I guess you'd say.
Do you remember your thoughts when the results came in? Like maybe McCarthy had a shot of toppling Johnson and going on to win the nomination?
That really didn't happen until President Johnson announced that he wasn't going to run again. We really didn't understand how significant this result was, particularly on Lyndon Baines Johnson and his how it dispirited him and made him believe that the war was probably unwinnable and that he ought to dedicate himself to trying to end it. So it had a profound effect, but we didn't. We were filled with our, you know, giddiness and thinking we could lick the world, but really, in point of fact, we knew that it was still very much an uphill battle. But it was Johnson's announcement that really blew open the whole issue, and we realized suddenly what we had done.
Of course, in between New Hampshire and Johnson dropping out of the race came this.
I am announcing today my candidacy for the presidency of the United States. I do not run for the presidency merely to oppose any man, but to propose new policies.
That was Bobby Kennedy getting into the race 4 days after New Hampshire. How stunned were you at that? And how angry were you?
Very. We had worked really hard. I mean, I came close to, I think, flunking out of college at that point in time. But a lot, you know, we had done it, and now it was as though we just kind of step aside and let the Kennedy forces take over, and we would be just, you know, swept away. So we were there, and so by Indiana, when it was McCarthy versus Kennedy, it was a nasty, miserable fight between two friends, and we all threw ourselves into it thinking, well, you know, this is the most important thing. Well, it wasn't, of course, but that we had forgotten that we were opposing the war, and we got into opposing Kennedy.
I was just thinking as you were saying that, John, that I wondered, did Kennedy replace Johnson as the enemy?
In a way, the emotions were so high at that point that we got into that. And then we felt, I mean, as soon as, obviously, the night that Kennedy was shot, you realized how far you'd gone along that road of substituting a political movement for what you're really trying to accomplish. And that was embarrassing. I mean, I felt it.
Looking back at that 1968 primary in New Hampshire, do you have final thoughts or lasting thoughts? Or was it a special time, a sad time? It seems like a combination of emotions there.
It was. For one thing, it didn't end the war. It didn't. It went on and on and on and on.
And Richard Nixon was elected that year for president.
That's right. And so it, in the end, what did we do? Well, I think we made some statements about how important it is to get out there and do it, and that you can take on the system and you can fight uphill and you can at times win. So I remember going to one of my reunions at Amherst, and a fellow came up to me and said, you know, I want to thank you for doing the McCarthy thing. He didn't do it, but he said what it gave me was a sense that I could be a part of history, and I didn't know that up to that point. And I thought, well, that's interesting, isn't it, that it had that kind of effect on people.
John Tague is an attorney in Concord, New Hampshire. A half century ago, he was a volunteer for Gene McCarthy, campaigning for president in New Hampshire during his bid for the Democratic nomination. John, thank you so much for being on the program.
Great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It was 50 years ago this week, on March 12, 1968, that Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy ran much closer to President Lyndon Johnson in the Democratic primary in New Hampshire than anyone had expected. A key factor that led to the withdrawal of Johnson as a candidate for re-election just over 2 weeks later. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
If you love your country and the things for which it stands, vote for Gene McCarthy and bring peace to this our land.
The 1968 New Hampshire primary was just the beginning of a year filled with political drama, tragedy, and chaos. In a couple of weeks, we'll begin a three-part series here on The Political Junkie called 1968, 50 Years Later. I'll be looking back at the big political storylines from that pivotal year and discussing the impact they had on the country then and now. You can find out more about the series on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. And that's it for this week's show. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
But the dream has not yet died, my friend. The times can still be changed. With courage, we can right the wrong.